The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
She's a little aggressive, involved, but she's smart and she likes smart women.
Who doesn't?
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 456 for the week of April 24th, 2023. I am Ad Hoc Kitchen Island Buffet David T. Cole, and I'm here with Breach Presentation Sarah D. Bunting.
My ass.
Extraordinary uterus, Tara Ariano.
It's real and it's spectacular.
And birthing Barbie Dreamhouse, Roxana Haddadi.
Utterly nothing good happens in this space.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Before we get into talking about dead ringers, I got a little bit of pod business up top. We are super close to hitting the next campaign milestone. It's possible by the time you hear this, we will have hit that milestone. When that happens, we'll be adding the not quite winners and losers of the week to the Extra, Extra Hot Great lineup. That's the segment where we pick some of the other contenders for winner and loser of the week and discuss. So sort of newsy, kind of servicey. Assuming that is nigh, you'll hear that starting with Extra, Extra Hot Great episode 240. Also, as part of this milestone is our first crowdsourced sticker. We already have a Discord channel going for that. And there's already some great suggestions like the caramel double saying, sorry. Or a this Benson sticker that's like all of TV's Benson as like one mishmash Leviathan of a
Mega
character.
Benson.
We got Benson. We've got SUV Benson, we've got regular show Benson, and they're all like all one Benson.
Yeah.
There's that sticker idea. Get your ideas in that channel. We'll do a poll at some point. Pick the best one. Do the art. And if you're a supporter, a club member, all you have to do is say, I want that sticker. Give us your address. And then magically an envelope will appear with that sticker in it. You'll be like, yeah, stickers. Hooray. And quickly, a follow-up on that double download issue we were talking about last week for sub-club members. Unsurprisingly, no real word from Patreon except to say that, yeah, it's a bug and we'll ignore it for the next 2 years. But just to visually help you from now on, the grandpa version of Extra Extra Great actually has an old man emoji on it now. And then the regular full-size version has the pepper emoji as usual on it. So you can see if you're getting both of them, which one you want to delete right away. That was a lot. As to say, thank you very much for your support. This has been great to see the second show grow so quickly. We're having a lot of fun recording them, answering your questions, both serious and stupid. I especially like those stupid questions. So keep them coming. Thank you, everybody, so much.
Yes, thank you so much. Patreon.com/extrahotgreat or extrahotgreat.com/club. Both of those will get you there. And the club link has more information about the campaign. And now, after sitting patiently through all of that, let us welcome in our guest. She is a TV critic at Vulture, whom you've heard with us before. Welcome back, Roxana Haddadi.
Roxana!
Thank you guys so much. I'm so excited to discuss a show as wonderfully disgusting as the one we're going to discuss.
That's right.
Let me ask you this. Are you a fan of gushiness?
Right? How much just viscosity can you handle?
Is that like a 10W30 you got going there?
All right. Well, we've already teased it. We're going to be talking about dead ringers, in which Beverly and Elliot Mantle, Rachel Weisz and Rachel Weisz, are identical twins practicing gynecology and obstetrics at a hospital in Manhattan. They are also roommates, codependent best friends, and occasionally they are each other for professional and otherwise purposes. Their ambition is to open a birthing center that will correct everything that's wrong with the childbirth process as it is currently conceived. And on the very eventful day we spend with them in the series premiere, we see what they're talking about. People die, babies die, bad things happen. They are also sometimes do a cheeky swap of one another's identities, as I alluded to. They change their hair, lipstick, and shoes as various situations may require. The original inspiration for a story about twin gynecologists who are also deeply weird was The Strange Death of the Twin Gynecologists, a New York Magazine cover story by Linda Wolf in September 1975. We'll link it in the show notes. It was a true story. That inspired the novel Twins by Barry Wood and Jack Gieseland. David Cronenberg adapted that as a feature film in 1988. And that movie is less loosely the inspiration for the show, which was created by Alice Birch, formerly a writer on Normal People and Succession. The premiere plus two other episodes were directed by Sean Durkin of Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene fame. Let's do the Chen check-in. Roxana, should our listeners watch Dead Ringers?
Yes. It's my simplest, most direct answer. Yes.
Sarah.
Absolutely not.
Ooh. Dave.
It's a lot, but it's got confidence.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the middle of Sarah and Roxana. I would say you're going to know very quickly if this is something that you want to watch. All right, let's get into the nitty gritty. Roxana, you tweeted that you feared Dead Ringers might suffer the same fate as Too Old to Die Young, extremely good and weird and overlooked, and something you hope eventually gets a physical media release you can treasure. Please use this platform to explain what you feel makes Dead Ringers essential viewing.
I think what makes it essential viewing is the lead performance is, to me, the best of Rachel Weisz's career. I think that she is so subtle and nuanced in differentiating between Beverly and Elliot, between what makes them tick, between that weird shared sibling language that no one else understands if you're outside of that relationship. Mm-hmm. I think that she is really in control of how codependent and toxic these women are, but also how much they've convinced themselves that they're doing something that is good and correct and going against how racist and sexist this field of medicine started out as. So I really think that there is a confidence there, to echo what's been said before, a confidence in that performance that made it very compelling for me to watch. I also think that it's disgusting in a in a level that I really appreciated. That was not easy for me to watch. I did a lot of watching through my fingers, mainly because I don't plan on having children. And seeing that many births was a lot.
Yeah.
But I liked it as a portrait of people in free fall, unaware that they're in free fall, manipulating each other, being manipulated, and doing all that sort of like nasty stuff that I like in television. So for me, it felt like the first episode, once I got through that and sort of understood what the tone was and what the show was trying to do, I was very into it.
So, Sarah, I feel like you wouldn't disagree with a lot of the points that Roxana was making, but you arrived at the opposite conclusion. So explain.
Yeah, I agree that this is a gorgeous performance. And I agree that the show absolutely has tonal confidence and narrative confidence. But I had a feeling at the end of 90 seconds that I did not want to spend any more time with it. And it's not that it's disgusting. I went to girl school for 12 years. They showed us a lot of fucking scare videos to make sure we didn't get pregnant and embarrass them. So, like, that's not the issue. I think the sort of overarching politics of it are not the issue. But as the episode went on, I just was consistently, repeatedly put off by this sophomoric seeming to me, look at how much we're swearing. If I think you're swearing too much, you're fucking swearing too much. Look at us pushing boundaries. Look at us turning up the Foley on this squelching. Look at us sort of violating the audience's trust with the with these anti-hero leads. I just wish the performance were in something else that wasn't let's shoot OBGYN Brazil on the old sets from Fight Club. Like, it just felt really immature, performatively gross, and I don't like it. I don't think it's bad. I don't think anyone's wrong to enjoy it and respond to it. I just found it, like, I don't know, sophomoric. And I'm done.
I think everything that you said plays into like my takeaway from this show, which is it is one of the most breathless shows I've watched in a while. Everything you just said, like just how just the production is a lot, the characters mm-hmm. are a lot, the dialogue is a lot. Like there's literally a scene in the first episode where one of the twins is running up and down a stairs in the most sort of landlocked pedo conference scene you've ever witnessed mm-hmm. where she's breathless. And like, you know, so they're even doing like a meta commentary on their own breathlessness within the first episode. But like the show just doesn't give you a chance to like sit back and think about anything. At the end of the episode, I was like a little tired. And I feel like you either have a reaction to that, which is I enjoyed sort of the tone they brought to that. Or that plus the tone was too much for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I understand both sides of it so well because, like, was interested in where they're going to go with this because they're, like, it's not the good twin and the evil twin. It's the asshole twin and the bad twin. Like, there's, like, no, there's nobody here to root for. Mm-hmm. Like, the people right. that are trying to get money from for their birthing center idea, they're assholes. Like, there's nobody here except for the victims of the system that pass through the story that you feel sorry for. And it just is weighty. Mm-hmm. It's a show that really, like, you watch an episode and you kind of just have to take a moment. And it is not a bingeable show, you know? It is definitely a show that you want some space between things.
I binged it.
Oh, did you? Wow, yeah, I couldn't. I could not.
Yeah, it is a confrontational show, and I think there is a place for that, and I value that in the abstract. Actually continuing with this show is not going to be something that I can do.
Not only did I have to take a breather after the first episode, I felt like I needed a breather after the surrogate client mother scene, where there's the super bitchy Absolutely. Rich woman who's just like, doesn't give a shit about anything about herself, and is like, so overwrought and probably Sarah would say overwritten and, you know, everything. But like it was so effective in making me angry tired that I wanted to take. And that's sort of like the theme for this. Like this is a show that I didn't not enjoy.
Yeah.
But it made me sleepy.
Okay. Well, I'm going to bring it back to Roxana because I think I'm the closest to her. Like I feel like you and I have the same sort of sensibility where like once I found out this was a writer who had worked on Succession, I was like, this makes a lot of sense where like this is this is where the tone specificity of like walking the line between drama and horror and comedy comes from. So talk about that.
Where every line of dialogue is like a mean, flirtatious insult.
Yes.
Between sisters. I do respond to that. Mm-hmm. I sort of enjoy, not sort of, because I did enjoy watching it. I liked sort of the overwritten nature of the dialogue. I liked that there were still punches hidden underneath sort of that overwrought feeling. Mm-hmm. I brought up Too Old to Die Young because I feel like Nicholas Winding Refn, this is exactly his bag. He tests you to see how much patience you have for his morally terrible, beautiful to look at characters. Mm-hmm. And I guess I enjoy putting myself through the ringer in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, didn't mean to make that a pun with dead ringers, but I do think that there, you know, there is something to be said about the fact that if you respond to the pacing of Succession, which is everybody running to outsmart each other, very little actually gets done because they're just wrapped up in their own petty dramas and competitions. I do think sort of the way that this show is written, you could respond to and you could enjoy. And I think that ultimately what I appreciated about it is that late in the season, it does dig into the idea of, well, it's a mini series. So I say late in the season, but I mean late in the idea of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It does sort of dig into the question of like, when we talk about healthcare and we talk about empowering women and we talk about all these things related to self-care, what does that actually mean for different classes and for different parts of the country where people live? And for different ideologies of what medicine is supposed to give you. Mm-hmm. So I liked that while we're doing this whole like Rachel Weisz, you know, making kissy faces at herself in the mirror thing, we are also at least attempting to dig into what this field is, what would attract these women to it, and what is sort of the, you know, what is the myth of philanthropy and what that provides in this country to healthcare. So I do think that it is making some arguments that, again, will leave you angry, tired, but I like how it was willing to throw these big ideas out there, filter them through Vice's performance, and leave you unsettled. Mm-hmm. I guess that's just my thing. I do love TV that leaves you unsettled, and this will absolutely do that.
Yeah. I think to your point, that scene that Dave referred to with the surrogate, where the mother is just this, or the will-be mother, not the one who is currently pregnant, just keeps, she's mm-hmm. Awful bitch, and she keeps saying, like, I'm the patient, even though, you know, one of the twins has her arm up the other one, where it's like, okay, got it.
Can I illustrate the succession of it all with another? There's a scene relatively early on where the two sisters get out of their building and there is a beggar on the sidewalk, and the asshole sister somehow generously gives this person their designer glasses. Mm-hmm. And then she takes her sister's glasses off. Yes. And puts them on her. So basically she just donated her sister's glasses. And I thought that was just like a perfect 10-second character note. I was like, all right, got it. I know who these people are in a very broad stroke kind of way. And it seemed like it could have been a scene in Succession.
Mm-hmm. And I hadn't read the New York Mag story, like seen Cronenberg's movie. Then I read the New York Mag story. And then I finished watching the miniseries. And I was sort of blown away by the real story. It's one of those things where I just, one of those, like, these people are sort of hiding in plain sight and hiding behind the veneer of who a doctor is supposed to be. And honestly, the story, the real story might have messed me up more than the miniseries, just because I could not believe people would have that level of power over other people's bodies and also be that narcissistic and egotistic. So it might be hypocritical for me to be like horrified by the real story, but very entertained by the miniseries.
Yeah.
But you might, you know, that might be an interesting sort of line to discuss.
Yeah, that story is wild. I strongly recommend that everyone read it who is like in any way interested in the story, because It goes places. I don't think I realized when I watched Dead Ringers the movie, you know, many years ago. I didn't rewatch it for this, although I may now after I finished the series. But I didn't realize that it was like even loosely based on a real story of these like twins who, on the Upper East Side, who all of their patients apparently were like, I sometimes think it's the other one treating me. And were like, it was just this open secret.
Mm-hmm. And even other doctors were like, oh, yeah, we thought that, too. But they were brilliant. So... okay.
Yeah.
Great.
It's wild. So the original movie, as I said, it's a classic of the body horror genre. So, you know, recasting the leads as women, I think ratchets up the tension. And once I read that this was happening, I thought, of course, like I don't always necessarily need things to be remade. But reimagining this story with female leads, I thought was super interesting. Sarah, why don't you speak on that? And we'll go back to Roxana.
Well, this is one of the things that I sort of was very tempted at various points in the premiere to bail, because I was like, I don't want to be here. And I kind of resent feeling like I'm being a baby when it's like that, as it were, when it's like these antisocial personalities that I don't need to spend time with. But I did want to sort of let myself sit with the idea that this particular brand of almost like Daisy Buchanan-esque ass-holic carelessness and antisocial self-absorption is something that we just accept in a male character. But when it's women, we may find it harder to deal with. And it, you know, I'm thinking to myself, like, is that my issue that these characters are like particularly sort of spiky and salty to me because they're women and I don't want that. I don't think it's that. I think it's everything that I said before, but I also said before, like, I'm glad that this exists and is sort of like pushing on our ideas of what a woman antihero is or can be. I think that this at least has a different take on it. It doesn't just like change the names and put lipstick on the characters. It like really thinks about what this means for these characters to be women in this society.
Yeah.
I still don't quite, it doesn't do it in a way that I enjoy still, but
sure.
You know, it's like, okay, that's worthwhile. Yeah. Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And for sure, when I heard that this was being remade, I was like, I mean, it's hard to out Cronenberg.
Yeah.
I think that was attempted and it didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
But the original is fascinating. Jeremy Irons is always fascinating to watch work, especially when he's this person that's like barely human. He's just a sociopath, not to mention two people. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a good idea. I think it's really thought-provoking. I was compelled by thinking about why I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's not one of those things that I don't like because it's just a piece of shit. Mm-hmm. I just don't like it. So, but it's like good. It's like the good kind of you don't like it because it forces you to think about stuff. So
yeah.
Yay.
Mm-hmm.
Like broccoli.
Exactly like broccoli.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you think of the performance? Because that's one of the other things that you especially called out. And not only that, but I should also say it would be easy to do a gender flip with this and make like the other bad characters, like now they're all men, like the other bad doctor who leads to a patient's death, or the crooked philanthropist that's trying to like launder their reputation, but all of them are women. Which I also thought was like, that feels very a real intentional choice.
Yeah. And the whole, which wife is this again? And like that whole conversation, I was like, I mean, this is a thoughtful show for sure.
Yeah.
And there are things later in the season, I would say, I think what Cronenberg did with the body horror of his adaptation was thinking specifically about, obviously, of course, our bodies and what they're capable of and what it means to be monstrous or grotesque, even if it's a natural function of the body. Like, that was always sort of my read on Cronenberg's film. Like when the twins fully break bad, it's because they begin considering their work as alien in a particular way. And I think that the miniseries does something very different, but more of this time in wading slightly into the abortion debate and wading slightly into cloning and doing some things later in the season that I think are less about making women's bodies like yucky and more about like how healthcare can be weaponized in yucky ways. That's probably not the most graceful way to talk about it, but I don't want to spoil things. I think it takes the horror from being like internal and external. And that sort of, that worked for me again in like a thought provoking, like, oh, okay, I see what you're doing sort of thing.
Yeah. Dave, there's a scene with a falafel guy. I feel like we shouldn't move on before we address it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't care if you're having a bad day. You don't piss off your falafel guy, especially if you got a favorite falafel guy. Because then you have to walk 4, 5, 6 city blocks at the next falafel guy, and his falafel is probably not as good as your favorite falafel guy. So just take a moment, have a timeout, and think about the falafel guy. One more thing before we go.
Okay.
Let the wide stick give you the edge. Speed Stick Super Dry Antiperspirant.
Dead ringers.
I did really want like a good street cart gyro after that scene.
Yeah.
Because it's rare to get a really good street cart gyro.
It's true.
Could have destroyed a falafel after watching that. Absolutely, 100%.
She really made it look delicious.
A shawarma platter of some kind.
Oh, yeah.
Just any sort of Mediterranean food brought to me would have been great.
I would say I mean, we don't have this sort of search capability yet.
Mm-hmm.
But if I could put in a search term that says, has there been more tahini on the mouth of an A-list celebrity on screen before? Please check. Answer, no. Rachel Weisz.
No.
You've created a whole new weirdo database. I love it.
This is the promise of AI. This is what AI should be doing. Mm-hmm.
Get on it, Mrs. Davis.
Tahini ground coverage meets Wolfram Elfra. We got it. All right. It's around the dial. Our first stop is Tara.
All right. Well, I want to talk about Love is Blind. Esther kind of stole my Around the Dial last week. Not really. Pretend I'm telling you to watch the wonderful second season of Somebody Somewhere on HBO and to watch the first season first if you haven't. And actually, even if you have already watched the first season, watch it again. I did that the week before last. It was an excellent use of less than 3.5 hours of my time. It's a wonderful show. But because I was watching two seasons of Somebody Somewhere for work, but also for my soul, it took me a while to finish up the fourth season of Love is Blind, a glorious shit show. So I feel like everyone's already chewed over the season proper. You don't need to tell me to tell you Micah's horrible. She made a horrible friend in the pods. Then she got out and introduced further horrible friends to her fiancé, Paul, who is also horrible. You don't need me to say no personal lives, but more determined to ignore all of her instincts in order to become a person who is married than Chelsea. You've already heard about Zach, the fourth property brother. Last week, you probably even read news reports about past show participants complaining that the process of being on the show was brutal and dehumanizing, which I'm sure is true. I also would have assumed that. It's one of the many reasons I would never do this reality show or any others, like not to victim blame, but making decisions that safeguard their personal welfare is clearly not top of mind for any of these dipshits when they sign up to be on Love is Blind. But that aside, Netflix was last week's loser on this podcast over its inability to deliver its live Love is Blind reunion, actually live, which is definitely embarrassing. Watching it a week later on tape delay, the reunion's many flaws just make me love it more. It's like a dog that keeps running into walls. It's dumb, but it can't help itself. It's just going to pick itself up and keep going. So here's some highlights. Irina got pretty good media training. She's the horrible friend. She walked right up to the line of saying it only seemed like she was toying with Zach's emotions because she asked to leave and she was not permitted to. I believe that happened, though. Chelsea's story about buying underwear for a partner she had not met yet was clearly supposed to show us her love with Kwame was meant to be and not that she was just looking for a male person she could dress up to fit her pre-existing image, and any would be fine. I hope Zach stays married, if only so I'm never exposed to his musical interpretation again. And Marshall saying both that he doesn't know what he would have said to Jackie at their wedding and that the wedding is the precipice of the experiment and that he was robbed of that moment. Complete telling on himself that he didn't care about the relationship as much as he wanted to be dramatic on television. But the true least valuable player is Vanessa Lachey. The lights come on. She grits her teeth through the explanation of what they've spent the last 90 minutes of broadcast delay doing. And when she grins, it does not touch her angry eyebrows. She made so many PAs cry that night. Oral history of the downtime of that Love is Blind reunion, please. Vanessa pre-interviews Jackie and Josh with all these softball questions and then is all, wow, when they cut back to Vanessa in the studio, like, yeah, you should really have a word with the person that conducted that interview you think is so bad. She keeps talking about which couple showed their devotion with matching outfits and demanding that one of them deliver the first Love is Blind baby so that she can be Auntie Vanessa. It is grim. There was a report today as we record this that she and Nick Lachey, her husband, also a host of the show, may be fired because they were so bad. I actually thought he was fine. It was mostly her. I don't think anything will probably come of it unless I'm wrong by the time you hear this, but I understand the impulse. She's terrible at her job. That was never clearer than when we had to see how she does it when she is not edited. But Love is Blind is stupid and great. I'm very excited for the all-lesbian season of The Ultimatum, its sister show, which was teased at the end starting May 24th. And for my plug back to Somebody Somewhere, I interviewed Jeff Hiller. He is great. The show is great. You can find the link to that at Cracked in the show notes.
I'm a little tired after listening to that, too.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Speaking of tired, angry, Love is Blind.
Roxanna, what do you have for us?
I guess I'm staying on theme with a general discussion of horrible people, continuing Dead Ringers, continuing Love is Blind, by sharing that we recently did a full rewatch of Seinfeld, which I had, of course, watched in rerun form. It was one of my dad's favorite shows, although he didn't understand a lot of the comedy. So I have a distinct memory of him asking us to explain what the contest was, like what the competition was. Which for a teenager, my brother and I were like, oh, I don't know, Dad. He can flip break you for this it. One down for you. Yeah. But it was really, you know, I really enjoyed rewatching it. Seinfeld, I think, has become this show rightfully, which also in my mind is affiliated with Jerry Seinfeld getting paid like $200 million for terrible stand-up specials and for dating teenagers. And of course, Michael Richards just like having a racist meltdown. So there had been sort of a shadow over the show in my mind for a while, but it felt like the perfect thing to like watch two episodes while eating dinner. And that's exactly what it was. It was great. There were so many episodes that I surprised myself by remembering a ton of dialogue from. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was shocked by the number of classics that are in the 9th season. How late George's pastrami sex is. How late Kramer puts the garbage disposal in his shower so that he can just be in the shower all the time.
That's right.
Yeah. All these incredibly stupid things that I really enjoyed watching and that brought back memories of me watching it with my dad. And I just really enjoyed that. And it's nice that they're all on Netflix. I don't have to have any commercial break pauses, although I'm paying for your streaming service. Like, get out of here, Peacock. But, I did really enjoy it. I might just wait and restart it again in a couple months. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find a sitcom that good.
It's true.
And,
it's true.
You know, things to plug. I don't know. You can find me on Twitter. You can find my work at Vulture. That's pretty much it.
When you rewatched the finale, did you have thoughts on, because everybody's like, well, this is how I would have done that last two-parter.
I actually thought that it was pretty solid. I think season 9 is so noticeable in that the characters are just absolutely terrible. Like, I think there's a real shift in 9 where they purposefully make George even more intolerable. They make Jerry even more narcissistic. Mm-hmm. Elaine is really in her I don't care about anybody else bag. Yeah. And Kramer is just at his most unhinged. Like, mm-hmm. there's that one scene where he spills juice and he uses Jerry's couch cushion to wipe up That's right. juice, which is just absolutely stupid. So I liked the fact that they were at their, you know, bottom level of humanity. And we did get the guest stars to call them out on that. And it also made me think, you know, I don't know where else it could have ended past an affirmation of the only thing these characters can do is bullshit each other in a room. Mm-hmm. And if that's going to be in a prison cell, that worked for me. But I also have no memory of watching the finale in real time. So I don't have a sense of what I originally thought about it. Was it really poorly received at the time? Did
it
people
was.
Like,
yes.
Like, yes. It was. I think for me, it wasn't the mean-spiritedness. For me, it was the fact that they felt like they needed to put a button on it. Like, Seinfeld and Harry Lee feels like a buttonless show to me. And if it was just another sort of episode that did something heightened, but wasn't necessarily putting the end in script at, you know, at the end of it, that I thought it might have been stronger.
No hugging, no learning. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It felt like a little bit of betrayal of that sort of sensibility to me. That's all. But I don't think it was bad.
That makes sense.
Some people, like, it was fine for me. I was like, oh, that was fine. But I kind of wish, you know.
Yeah. I imagine there are people who would say now, like, it's a shame they used trying to do the show so early.
Yeah.
Like, trying to do the Jerry show. Because if that had been the series finale and then they do it and then it is a flop, like, that would have been a perfect way to, you know?
I think also it happened, I mean, it was 25 years ago. And I was actually on the road at the time. So I was in some motel room in, like, South Carolina. And Frank Sinatra had just died, so it was like a really weird end of a bunch of New York eras.
Can you say Frank Sinatra died again?
Frank Sinatra died.
Boom, 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 boom.
Go on, Sarah.
Okay. Sinatra. So I think we as a culture were just way less attuned to the idea that this much hype around any one thing mm-hmm. was going to be a disappointment.
Yeah. Right.
And so I think we had just like, we were on the eve of starting Dawson's Rap, like for real, or we had just started like catching up on old episodes. And it was like, we just weren't as a culture that up on like how we should manage expectations.
Right.
And mm-hmm. the wet firecrackerness of it. Like, I remember it ended and I was like, you know, with a slice of fucking terrible Southern pizza in this hotel room, like, really?
All right.
Like, I rushed to get off the road for that. But I think if I watched it again, I would be a lot more tolerant of what they were up against in terms of expectations.
Totally.
Yeah.
All right. And rewinding back 5 minutes, you can find all of Roxana's stuff in the show notes.
Yeah.
All right, Sarah D. Bundy, what do you have for us?
This is actually not a horrible people being disappointing and off-putting note. Top Chef World All-Stars. This current season of Top Chef, it is an all-star season. As noted, it features winners and a couple of finalists from many of the international iterations of Top Chef. I didn't realize there were even this many, so that's going to be exciting, like summertime viewing. This is actually a tougher thing to pull off than the show makes it look. Top Chef underwent a sort of attitude sea change, definitely by the time the first of its pandemic seasons was underway, possibly before then, but I think it was the COVID season and all the circumstances around that that just like refocused everybody involved, especially the judge and host talent, on why they do the show, what is the point. Do you want to do this job or not? If you don't, life is short. All of this by way of saying that there was a certain portentous self-regard that had settled over the show, and it had reached the point for me where I was just not, it wasn't enjoyable for me. It didn't seem like it was enjoyable for Padma and Tom. And then fast forward a few years, and they both seem so much happier, more engaged, more grateful to be there and be talking about food and all be together as a group again. So much less humorless and do you know who I am-y about the whole process. So all that by way of saying that the Top Chef of 5 years ago would have been congratulating itself all day and half the night as well for being such a huge franchise and changing people's lives worldwide, blah, 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 literal fish cakes. And then just being joylessly didactic about international foodways. This is not that at all. Top Chef World All-Stars just lets its chefs do their things, talk about their food, their ways, talk about their backgrounds if they want, and doesn't bother if they don't. And Last Chance Kitchen has that same like lighter-hearted, curious energy. Yes, there is too much lingering on the BMW vehicles used in the production, but everybody seems in on that joke, and the chefs will be like, like doing a little Benny Hill dance and being like, boy, this BMW sure holds a lot of fat chefs and parsley and ramps. And you're like, okay, like, fine. And BMW apparently does not mind that they're being made fun of at the same time that they're getting the product placement. It's a fun season, and the drama on this show is now back in the skills and not on the people. And I am once again glad that Top Chef sort of looked at Anthony Bourdain's body of work and decided to take up that mantle instead of, like, I don't know, being in love with themselves and never laughing at anything. So I recommend it. It's all on demand. And if you are someone who needs to save time, Last Chance Kitchen does function in the same way that Drag Race is Untucked used to, where you could just sort of like watch that and have an eagle eye on, or an eagle eye view on what happened previously. And then you're caught up. For my plug, a reminder, Independent Bookstore Day is this Saturday.
Woo!
I run such a bookstore. It is called Exhibit B Books. It is all true crime. I have lots of new and mostly used genre books, magazines, and heritage media, by which I mean books on literal tape, LOL, ask your grandparents. In honor of Independent Bookstore Day, most of the shop will be on sale this weekend. I think our listeners might find particular utility in my hashtag as seen on television shelf. We will link that for you in the show notes. But even if you don't have any need for true crime, find an indie bookstore and buy something from them instead this weekend.
Woo! Can I ask, Sarah, do you have a chef you're rooting for?
I'm always rooting for Buddha. He's just really watchable to me. He'll sort of try anything. And just when you're like, oh, Buddha, like, you're so arrogant, this is never going to work, he'll just have this like giggling swear meltdown. And you're like, oh, yeah, good for you. But also Victoire is like so charismatic. Her story is incredible. Like, English, I think, is her seventh language. And she learned it 4 months ago. And listening to her speak it is like hearing your favorite song. And her food looks really delicious. So I'm rooting for those two. And also, you know, Potato Girl. I know it's not really been working out for her as much. But
Silwa, like, right?
Yeah. But this is the thing about Top Chef now. Like, you just kind of root for all of them. And as the season goes on, it starts to be painful that someone has to go home. Do you have any favorites in the crowd?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going straight, like, nationalism down the line and just voting for the Middle Eastern guy.
Right. Big fans of theirs also. There was a kibbe a couple weeks ago that I was like, can I climb into the screen?
The mushroom one.
Oh, God.
Yeah, the mushroom one looked really good. Yeah.
I think we all need to go eat. This is what I'm getting from this episode. Thanks for not great.
All right, coming up on this Friday's Extra Extra Hot Great is Max's Love and Death. We'll be talking about that. Plus your burning questions and Ask EHG. And then for the extra credit, we have a Power to the People May Day scenario there, where we're picking one willful character from a TV show. They're getting transported into a workplace show, and they're going to organize a union there. What happens? That is available to supporters. You can go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join or up your grandpa pledge in order to get that full episode. And then right here next week on EHG Prime, it is club member forcening of Spring Fling TV. So the theme is spring or fling or both, springing and flinging. We have a very broad collection of things that we're forcing to watch, and it was great fun. So check that out on the next EHG Prime.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is a familiar voice. It sounds like Mr. Dan Cassino.
Esteemed panel, valued guest, I'm here to present for your consideration Monk Season 5, Episode 2, Mr. Monk and the Garbage Strike. Now, this is my third shot at trying to get a gentle-ish mystery into the Canon Nodak, but I'm feeling good about this one. So let's go through the criteria. First off, a canon presentation must be for a show that is itself great and an outstanding episode of that show. So let's talk about whether Monk is a great show. I think this is pretty clear. It won 8 Emmys, 6 if we decide to ignore the ones that went to Randy Newman. It's also an important show, starting a trend of cable programming that defined basic cable for 15 years when channels like USA and TNT realized that they could do well not by pushing the envelope of content, high silk stockings, but by delivering shows that networks would have produced 20 years prior but weren't anymore. I have a deep affection for a lot of these shows, Psych, Royal Pains, Rizzoli and Isles, but Monk is the best of them. So it's a great show. The question is, what makes this episode a standout? First off, it lets Monk be a jerk. Now, while Monk is sometimes cuddly, especially when they pair him with a kid, Tony Shalhoub's Adrian Monk is not pleasant to work with. He's dismissive to his assistant, he annoys the hell out of the cops and the criminals. They work with him because he's good, and they have sympathy for his mental issues, but no one really likes him. In this episode, he figures out very quickly that the case in front of him was a murder, but if he says it was a suicide, the sanitation workers union will go back to the negotiating table and maybe end the garbage strike that's filled the studio backlot that's supposed to look like San Francisco up with garbage. So he says it was a suicide, telling himself and his assistant that it's for the greater good. Clip 1.
I am the hero here. You are not a hero, Mr. Monk. You are letting a killer go free so you can get your garbage picked up.
Okay, Natalie. Let me explain one more time about the greater good.
This brings us to point two. It gives his assistant something meaningful to do. Normally, the assistants are mostly there for the comedy bits, but here, Natalie, his second assistant, is the one who forces him to actually investigate the case by threatening to quit. He doesn't like to acknowledge it, but he needs her, so the blackmail works. Even if, at the end of the episode, he declares that everyone is a hero, except Natalie, because see point one. Third, this episode has some great comic bits. The mysteries in Monk aren't that complicated, and anyone paying attention at all figures them out pretty quickly. That makes it great for family viewing. It's one of my son's favorite shows, but also frees up space for the comedy, and this episode has some solid gags. Monk is constantly trying to pick up garbage without actually touching it. There's ridiculous cascades of garbage. There's the confetti when the garbage trucks come back, which he then expects the garbage collectors to pick up. There's the revelation that Monk has been dealing with his own garbage by mailing it, sorted by color and food type, to his therapist. And his insane plan to clean up the city by commandeering a garbage truck and doing it all himself. Clip 2.
Where are you going to put the garbage?
I got it all figured. When this truck's full, I'm going to drive it into the bay. Then come back, get another truck, keep driving them into the bay. One bag at a time. One truck at a time.
This culminates in a scene in a high-tech clean room where Monk is the happiest he's ever been, and he gives this ridiculous smile that's so perfect it wound up in the opening credits for the rest of the show's run. This episode all has some great guest stars. Sure, Chi McBride is as good as the mayor, but also from out of nowhere, Alice Cooper, if that is his real name. Clip 3.
Here's what happened. It is no secret that rock and roll stars collect antiques, especially antique chairs.
What the hell are you talking about?
Alice Cooper must have read about Jimmy Cusack's handcrafted wingback chair. He was consumed with envy. He was consumed with resentment.
See, Alice Cooper is a hippie, but the bad kind. Monk hates hippies, even if he doesn't seem entirely sure what they are. This leads to the biggest reason this episode should be in the canon. It breaks the form of the show. This is the first episode to have more than one here's what happened scene, in which Monk sums up the solution to the case. Monk is so distracted by the garbage strike that we get three of them, two of which are necessarily wrong. Clip 4.
So you were wrong? Because usually when you say here's what happened, it's pretty much what happened.
Captain, it's the stench. It's everywhere. I can't possibly...
It wasn't the mayor, Monk.
No.
Oh, hell.
This episode gives us everything you expect from a Monk episode. A relatively simple mystery, comedy beats, a great scene with the therapist, Dr. Kroger, played by the late Stanley Kamel, and the deep idiocy of Randy Disher, now the police chief of Summit, New Jersey. I'm not going to say every episode of Monk is great. There are some stinkers, especially when it got real self-indulgent later seasons. But this episode is everything that made Monk a great show. Some great guest stars, and breaks the form of the show to deliver comedy, which was always the show's main brief. Hope you see fit to sort it into its only possible place, lined up perfectly with the rest of the canon.
Thank you, Dan.
Love it.
Roxana, you chose this from our list of submissions. Please start us off. What did you think of the episode and of Dan's argument?
Dan's argument is basically just what I was going to say. Kudos to Dan's incredibly comprehensive and thorough breakdown. I wrote in my notes a lot of things that aligned here. Monk is just so self-involved and jerky, and it's very enjoyable to watch Tony Shalhoub slide into that mode so easily. I think about him throwing the confetti for the sanitation workers after the strike has ended and then telling them that they need to clean it up off the street. There are all these little moments where, on the one hand, yes, this character has like certain things that he's living with that everybody is aware of. But on the other hand, he just can be incredibly selfish and dismissive. And unfortunately, I guess this entire episode is how much I like selfish and dismissive characters. So I did react to that. I also am charmed by the Alice Cooper cameo. He's clearly having a ball in this black and white, what could have been sequence, just like dancing around the union president's office before he maybe shoots him in the head. So that's all really fun. And yeah, I like the production design of this trash just falling out of the sky while Monk is in the meeting with his therapist, just piling up on the street. so many different colored trash bags, so many different shapes. So just visually, I also really like that the episode got grimy and gross, and for me, seemed to back up everything that is making Monk act this way in a very visual way that you can understand, like, why these things are linked. I don't know if I entirely buy the Monk is the one show that started this string of, like, basic cable programming. I feel like I don't know enough about the timeline to completely credibly accept that. But as an episode of Monk, and an episode of Monk that sort of toys with what we've come to expect, I would say, yes, canon worthy.
Okay, I feel like Dave and I should go in the middle as the non-Monk watchers, and then Sarah should wrap up at the end. Right. So I'll go next. One of the things that I was struck by watching this, and I said this to Dave, is there's really nothing worse than a garbage strike, and we lived through at least one, if not more, when we lived in Toronto. And they knew what they were doing. They struck in, like, July, August, and that is the most disgusting time of year in Toronto anyway, regardless of whether there's truly, like, people just driving to Christie Pitts Park and just throwing trash cans into it, or trash bags into it, which they did.
We had a park. It's called Pitts for a reason. It's just a big pit, and it can hold a lot of garbage. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know anything about Toronto weather, the height of summer not only is very hot, even if you're like, Canada's always cold. No, it's hot. It's like hot. And then very humid.
Mm-hmm.
So the stink was just sticking to everything. It was so gross.
So as a premise for an episode of Monk, which is a show I have never watched before, we were made to do it here, but I obviously live in culture. I knew what it was about. And I thought that was a really very clever setup for an episode. And I was kind of surprised it was season 5 because it felt like that was something he should have had to deal with before. That would be that he would have been confronted by something that confronting, frankly. And there were a couple of good moments. I enjoyed him with the therapist, the great Stanley Camel, our Starverse king, just letting Monk talk and talk and talk. And then just that look on his face. And then, are you sending garbage to my house? Like, that was good. That was a very good scene. I also Dan cited it, the Alice Cooper fantasy of, like, why he was doing what he was doing, and that it was in pursuit of his collection of antique chairs.
But the fact that he just nonchalantly, confidently put out there, that,
as you know,
all rock stars are into antique chairs.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, he's reading Chair Digest.
So good. Yes. I thought that was very funny, too. But I'm with Roxana. I don't know how important the show was, you know, overall. Winning a lot of Emmys doesn't necessarily mean your show is great either. Sorry. Like, it just doesn't.
Mm-mm. The Modern Family, like, we can point at a lot of shows that win a lot of Emmys. It's
very true. And I appreciate that this one breaks the form, and I could tell from watching it that, like, it's a big deal. The clip that we heard was like, he's never wrong. That part of it is interesting. But then at the end where it's like, I feel like someone who has OCD would never touch confetti, never mind throw it on the ground and then expect anyone else to pick it up. Like, they would have a horror of confetti.
Of his illness are very nebulous. He's a germaphobe, but he'll sit in the bloody chair at the crime scene as part of his investigation. There's, like, little things like that where I'm like, I feel like they needed, like, a Monk do's and don'ts, because I wasn't getting a clear read on what his neuroses truly were.
Yeah.
But overall, this episode just feels like good hotel TV to me. Mm-hmm. Monk is a fun show. It is a light show. Mm-hmm. I feel like every episode sort of gives you the same thing as any other episode. It's like this, that kind of show, right? It's Murder, She Wrote. It's Columbo. It's Monk. The fact that they do finally do the 3 times in one episode, how they did it thing, reminds me of the time they did the fake cold open in CSI, where they're about to go, meow, and then, like, goes away. Oh, wait a second. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
that kind of stuff. It's always fun. I had a fine time watching this episode. I thought it was perfectly cromulent.
Yep.
Some few questions I had. Can you even buy metal trash cans? You know, those traditional metal trash cans?
Like an Oscar the Grouch style.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Bring back the metal trash cans. I loved UPS and garbage. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really good.
Yep.
And it didn't dawn on me that's what he was doing for some reason.
Well, I knew that he was sending it to someone, but the reveal that it was his therapist, I thought was very good.
Yeah. The whisper spot bit was kind of bad. Telegraph. Yeah. Poorly edited, that, yeah. too.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And the sign is so big. There's no way they could be like, whoops! It. Like, it's this big.
And it's in City Hall. Like, they would know. Yeah. It's dumb.
Yeah. 5 seasons in, they would know.
Yeah, it was a little farcical. And when it comes to City Hall, there's some other weird things. Like, why was there a property of City Hall umbrella in the episode?
Yes. That was like, had a little space for it to be engraved there professionally.
Well, you know, we all enjoy a good 4 imprint product. 4 imprint, for certain. But I don't think they have umbrellas for City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
For me, this Monk episode is just like perfectly fine middle of the road TV. I don't really think it elevates itself that much beyond the formula for this sort of Blue Skies USAE kind of show. I enjoy the ride, but I don't really think I would put it up in the canon spot.
All right, Sarah, tell us your thoughts.
I am not sure what to do about this. This is an interesting pick for the canon, especially since the episode just prior to this was the one in which Stanley Tucci is playing Monk in some in-production, and is following him around, and then is acting like him, and then there's a, you know, murder, obviously, and
that's
here's
cute.
What happened, etc. So that was the season premiere, and that, I think, is a much more, like, memorable episode that kind of hangs a light on all of the, not minuses, but like the ways in which this is not prestige TV and is perfectly cromulent hotel television. I do think this is a slightly above average episode. Definitely the timing is a little tighter, with some exceptions. The whisper spot thing was stupid, but with some exceptions, they were just jumping each other's lines better, particularly Ted Levine. Like, Randy's like, should I be writing this down? And the captain's like, nope. And just like the way certain exchanges like that were timed, that Monk is like completely around the bend pitching the mayor on like, here's my pitch. We burn the city down. We throw it in the garbage.
That was funny.
We burn those ashes and then we start over.
Yeah.
We can even straighten out Lombard Street. Like, okay. Ha. And, you know, I haven't slept in 9 days and trash bags coming down. And then again, Alice Cooper, who I guess was in a hotel room of his own enjoying the show and jumped at the chance to be on it and read Chair Digest, a publication that, should it actually exist, I would be interested in reading about the wonderful wild world of wing chairs.
Mm-hmm.
But with that said, like, is it enough? I was talking about this with the real monkologist in the household, my husband, Dan, who is the one who got me into the show. And it's like, this is why you like the show.
Right.
There are no lows. Mm-hmm. There are no super highs.
Right.
It's the being on Paxil of basic cable.
It's Monksil.
Everything's just kind of compressed into a predictable, consistent, cromulent.
Yeah.
Middle.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as I enjoyed watching this and appreciate the shout out from Mr. Dan Cassino about future Summit Chief of Police Randy Disher, who would probably be the best one we've had in a while. Sorry, Mr. Formicella. I don't think this is a show that has a canon entry in it.
Right.
And that would be an interesting thing to debate later at some other time, but I guess we should vote now and see where we end up. Although I think I know.
Okay, let's see. Roxana, what do you think about this Monk episode? Canon worthy, yay or nay?
I'm going to still say yay because I know I'm outvoted and I'm going to throw it a vote.
Maybe it'll be an exciting 11th hour turn. Tara.
I empathize with Dan Cassino. I am well known as a Royal Pains fan on this podcast, and I'm also the person who pitched A Mom, A New Adventures of Old Christine, and A King of Queens to the canon, so I know where he's coming from. But for me, like, I mean, Sarah said it perfectly, that it's like, it's a middle chunk show, and that's wonderful when that's what you're in the mood for, but for me, this was not canon worthy, but I wasn't mad about it.
Dan, partner in crime on the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show. One of the definitions of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And here we are. I'm going to say no to this one, but I certainly enjoyed the episode. But I think Sarah nailed it for me, which is, this is a show that's compressed mm-hmm. and has neither high nor lows and is consistently, it's like, you know, it's like a Dunkin' Donuts coffee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Always an 87.
That's the job done. That's it.
I mean, honestly, it's actually like living in Summit. It's it's perfectly nice. It's lovely there if that's what you're in the mood for. But yeah, no. not for me anymore. So yeah, thank you for the presentation. Excellent work. Good try, but no.
All right, so that means that Monk Season 5, Episode 2, Mr. Monk and the Garbage Strike, you are hereby not inducted into the Extra Hot Gray Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
Last Saturday, I got an email blast with the subject line, announcing CNN's King Charles with Gayle King and Charles Barkley. And my first thought before I actually read the email was, that's who they got to anchor their coronation coverage? That's not the case. What it actually is
Gayle...
Sadly, I mean, that part is sad. What's fine is Gayle King and Charles Barkley are going to be hosting a weekly talk show together on CNN. And I'm actually interested to see how that goes. I think they might be fun. I'm sure that they've done a lot of chemistry tests first before they announced it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm also a little bit sad that we're not going to get to see Charles Barkley try to do patter about Charles' coronation, because that would have been something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he would just openly be either sleeping or scheming for a snack. And relatable.
Relatable. Very relatable.
I saw a commercial where he plays him and his younger self.
Yeah.
And it was dynamite. Dynamite!
Yeah, that's the kind of chemistry Gayle King has to try to match between Charles Barkley and young Charles Barkley, pasted on some body double's face.
Sarah, who is her loser of the week?
Oh, boy. America's Next Top Model, now and forever. As alumna Lisa D'Amato compares shooting the show to the Stanford prison experiment, and given that she also wound up on Celebrity Rehab, I am inclined to believe Lisa.
Well, speaking of the Stanford prison experiment, do you know what time it is?
Is it game time?
It's game time.
It's non-regulation game time. We are between game time seasons, so as is our custom, I have created a non-regulation game time so that Dave may play it. And this non-regulation game time is called Little Twin Stars. In honor of our lead topic today, I made a game all about actors playing two different characters in the same primetime show. What I have not included is dual roles where the second one is just the first from a different dimension, so there's no evil Spock. And
gotcha.
We're also not talking about instances where the same actor plays different one-off characters in a serialized show. So sorry, Dave, no 1 million Robert Culps from his various Columbo appearances. And no show is in here more than once, although some actors are. I'll give you the name of two characters who were played by the same actor and the genre and network of the show that they were in. You give me the name of the show for 2 points. If you need a hint, I'll give you the actor, then you get 1 point. You're getting a lot of info right up top, so there's no free guesses, even though this is non-regulation game time. I had to draw the line.
Tough but fair.
Well, there's 18 questions plus a tiebreaker, no equal, blah, 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 none of the usual stuff, no steel meals. Mm. Here are the stakes.
Ooh.
Sarah and Roxanne are playing for 5 steel meals.
Holy
cow.
They
all just got wiped out by Dave.
Okay.
Dave is playing for 5 steel meals that only he will be able to use on the next non-regulation game time. So he could be stealing left and right.
Mm.
Yes, Dave.
Can I instead of giving them, can I subtract ones people have?
No.
Ah, all right. Fine.
Do you have any questions?
What's the fastest land animal?
Why is Dave like this?
The cheetah.
It's Robert Culp. Let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first.
It's Robert Culp.
It's Robert Culp.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. Our order is Sarah, Roxana, Dave. Are you ready to play Little Twin Stars?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm frightened, but yes.
Sarah, don't be frightened. This means nothing. Sarah.
It's horrifying.
Michael Knight and Garth Knight in an action drama from NBC.
Knight Rider.
That is correct for 2 points. We're starting with the easy ones. Roxana, Chip Baskets and Dale Baskets in a dramedy from FX.
Baskets?
Baskets is correct for 2 points.
It does seem too easy, doesn't it?
It's going to get harder. Yeah. Dave, Phoebe Buffay and Ursula Buffay in an NBC sitcom.
Okay, I assume it's not a trick question. It's Friends?
Friends is correct.
All right. Were they both in Mad About You?
I don't think
you?
Phoebe was ever
Ursula
on Mad About,
and Mad About
You.
You, right?
Yeah. Yeah. All right, back to Sarah. Patty Lane and Kathy Lane in an ABC sitcom.
Patty Lane and Kathy Lane. Hint.
Your hint is a pretty good hint. Patty Duke.
Oh, the Patty Duke Show.
It's correct for 1 point. Roxana, Petra Solano and Anushka Archuleta in a CW dramedy.
In a CW dramedy?
Yes.
Can I get a hint?
You can. Your hint is Yael Grobglas.
That gives me absolutely nothing. A CW dramedy. I don't know. Heart of Dixie? What is a CW dramedy?
Jane the Virgin is a CW dramedy.
Oh, get out of here. I've never watched that show.
Get out of here.
Well, you can talk to Catherine when you get to work tomorrow.
I know.
Ooh, yeah, true.
Dave.
Yeah.
Frankie Martino and Vincent Martino in an HBO drama.
Frankie Martino. So, two characters, same actor.
Yep, that's the premise.
Yeah. Sometimes, sometimes I gotta pull the cord on my brain.
Sure.
By restating the obvious. Hint, please.
Your hint is James Franco. R.I.P.
Oh, yeah, we miss him.
Do we?
Oh, the Deuce.
The Deuce is correct for 1 point.
Nice pull.
Sarah D. Bunting, Terry Spencer, and Monique Duran in a Fox drama.
I am not sure that it is this, but I don't know what else it would be, so let's try it. Models, Inc.
Correct!
Oh!
Both played by Stephanie Romanoff in Models, Inc.
Wow.
Bless.
Should have probably been saying who the actors were. Oops. To Roxana. Steve Wood and Ben Wood in a Netflix dramedy.
Oh my God. I'm going to mess up the name of it. Is it Dead to Me?
It is Dead to Me. Good for 2 points. Good. Both played by James Marsden.
I was about to say the difficulty ramped up very quickly, but everybody's getting 2 points and I'm feeling the pressure.
Well, Dave, let's see how you do with this one and then we'll do a score break because this is a quick, cheeky game.
Yep.
Nurse Laverne and Nurse Shirley in an NBC sitcom.
And ABC sitcom.
That's true.
This is Scrubs.
This is Scrubs, played by Aloma Wright. Let's get them scores.
I can't believe I didn't get the Scrubs question. I would have fucked it up. Very close game so far. Roxanne has 4. David T. Cole and I each have 5.
Okay.
I'm scared.
Back to the game. Sarah D. Bunting, Dominic Birdsey, and Thomas Birdsey in an HBO miniseries.
Hint, please.
Mark Ruffalo.
I don't remember the name of this. I can picture the...
I've done it! I've confused the title with all my stuff!
A show we watched and did not like. We covered it on this podcast.
I keep wanting to call it the Misery Index. That's not it. No, wait. It's Lie to Me? No. It's not Lie to Me.
I know this much is true.
I know this much is true.
These things I believe.
These things I believe.
I want to believe.
Everything sucks.
That my insistence on always calling that show these things I believe stole those points away from you, Sarah.
Perhaps. Back to Roxana.
Okay.
I didn't need the help. Thanks, though.
Spencer Hastings and Alex Drake in an ABC Family drama. I believe it was ABC Family in the entire time. Might have been Freeform at the end.
ABC Family. Secret Life of the American Teenager? What was it? No? What was it?
Pretty Little Liars.
Oh, yeah.
Characters played by Troyan Belisario, daughter of Donald, creator of Quantum Leap.
Oh, man. No. No.
All right, Dave.
Yes.
Samantha Stevens and Serena, no last name, in an ABC sitcom.
Once again, names?
Samantha Stevens and Serena, just Serena, yeah. In an ABC sitcom.
Oh, I feel like just one name should be a big clue. And I'm going to need the hint.
Your hint is Elizabeth Montgomery.
Oh, right. This is Bewitched?
It is Bewitched. Good,
yeah,
for one
that was
point.
A good hint.
She also played Lizzie Borden, apparently.
Really?
What?
Yeah, the more you know.
I was going to have Jeannie and brown-haired Jeannie in this, but brown-haired Jeannie doesn't have a name. They just call her Jeannie's sister. So, isn't that weird? Anyway, back to Sarah. Sarah Manning and Allison Hendricks in a BBC America drama.
Orphan Black?
Correct. I just picked the first two.
Nicely back done.
Back to Roxana. Elena Gilbert and Catherine Pierce in a CW drama.
Clue me.
Your clue is Nina Dobrev.
Oh, Vampire Diaries?
Correct. For one point.
Excellent clue. Thank God, man.
David.
Yes.
Larry Lehman and Lenny Lehman in a Showtime sitcom.
Yes. Edge of my brain. Edge of my brain, come forth.
These things I
believe. These things you believe.
Temporal lobe. Black Monday.
Black Monday's correct. Both played by Ken Marino. Nice.
Wow. Nice.
Let's get a score break. You have one question left. This one, we are zipping through this game.
Was that 2 points for David T. Cole just now?
Correct.
Okay. David T. Cole has jumped into the lead with 8. I have 7. Roxana has 5.
Whoa. Ooh. All right. Let's see what happens now. Sarah D. Bunting, Martin Payne, and Shanaynay Jenkins in a Fox sitcom.
Martin.
Martin is correct for 2 points.
Didn't overthink it.
No.
Nope. Mm-hmm.
Roxana. Emmett Stussy and Raymond / Ray Stussy in an FX drama. Might be Stussy. S-T-U-S-S-Y. Emmett and Ray / Raymond.
Okay. Yeah, I need a clue.
Your hint is Ewan McGregor.
Fargo?
Fargo's correct for 1 point.
Season 3?
Shit,
okay.
Nice.
Dabe.
Okay.
George Bluth and Oscar Bluth in a Fox sitcom.
Oh, boy. That's a easy one to end up on because that is Arrested Development.
It sure is for 2 points. Let's get the scores.
Roxana has 6. I have 9. Nice. And David T. Cole is our victor with 10.
Hey!
Nice.
Should we play the tiebreaker just for glory?
Yes.
All right,
yes.
Dave, you sit out. You already won.
Yeah. Okay.
Your characters are Maddie Ferguson and Laura Palmer in an ABC drama.
Twin Peaks.
I was wondering when that would come up.
That's why it's a tiebreaker.
I think that was a tie on the tiebreaker, so I think we should each give them half a steel meal somehow. No.
Sure.
Each give them one.
How do you have half a steel meal? All right.
Let's each just have a meal.
Falafel. Falafel for everybody.
Everybody's sad.
That's wonderful.
Dave!
Thank you, Tara. Fun game.
Woo!
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We discussed the hair up, hair down psychological thriller, reimagining Dead Ringers, before going around the dial stops at Love is Blind, Seinfeld, and Top Chef World All-Stars. Dan didn't clean up with his canon presentation of Mr. Monk and the Garbage Strike, but we did crown winners and losers of the week, and David T. Cole, hey, that's me, was the winner of this week's Game Time from Tara. Next up, Love and Death and more on Friday's Extra Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, it's the Spring Fling Listener Forsapalooza. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Rebecca thinks babies are boring.
Sarah D. Bunting.
People die from smells every day.
And Roxana Haddadi.
I'm not clever enough for this.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra. Hot Great.
Okay, well, thank you for all of that. Can I go?
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.